White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Now,
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana on December the 20th, 2014. And just remember, tomorrow is winter solstice begins. So the rebirth of the sun can be celebrated. And it's Saturn's day. And today is another Sling Blade show. And so while we're going back in the bunker and into the archives and digging it out, well, you get a beer or a cup of coffee and get ready, because here we go.
In part two of part one of Michael C. Rupert's talk about 9/11, on the other side of this, I hope you hear the other side before you hear this side. I cut it off at like the 35-minute mark, and I took the tape out, but I kept listening to what he was talking about, and he said some interesting stuff, so I kind of regretted shutting the tape off on the other side. So stand by and let me find the minute mark where he left off at. I think stuff is very formative. It helps us to take the shades off our eyes and realize the world is just not what we thought it was. Let's see this. Here it goes.
The people involved in that didn't leak until they finally announced it. Of course, they crashed a few and all that stuff, but people didn't really know what it was. And it's all dealt with, and I come from that milieu. I was raised in that milieu, and I worked, you know, the CIA tried to recruit me because of my family background when I was a cop. But, I mean, I grew up knowing about compartments. I had a Q clearance because I lived in the same house with my parents. I'm serious, because my dad might have left his briefcase open. You deal with that by compartmentalization. A guy mining some uranium ore in Tennessee wouldn't have any idea that he was doing it for an atom bomb. A guy mixing epoxy resin wouldn't have any idea that it was to create a radar-proof paint or adhesive to go on the outside of a stealth fighter. And what you do need are certain key people in key locations who do know at least most of or a significant part of in a secret compartmentalized intelligence, SCI, that's an official term, operation. And I found several, but this is my favorite of all the ones in 9/11. Dave Frasca, who was head of the Radical Fundamentalist Unit, he stepped on five separate investigations, each one of which could have prevented the attacks. Five. He stepped on... There was an investigation of two of bin Laden's relatives in early 2001. The White House issued an order, which he then put out to the field, saying, stop investigating these two brothers of Osama bin Laden, who were living in Falls Church, Virginia, right next to CIA headquarters. That's a clue. Chicago agent Robert Wright, heartbreaking press conference where he cried and apologized to the people. He had penetrated al-Qaeda financing. Dave Frasca took away his computers, sent him down to the basement where water pipes were dripping on his desk. You should have heard of the Phoenix memo circulated by Kenneth Williams that was suppressed about all the guys taking flight training. And by the way, we'll deal with the hijackers briefly when I tell you that, seven of them are still alive, according to BBC and ABC and Newsday and, you know, major press sources. I believe the planes were flown by remote control. And I believe that at least five to seven of them, we know that five had received training at U.S. military facilities. That came from Newsweek magazine. And so some of them, I think, were government agents who were still alive. And the others were cannon fodder. The others, you know, they call them the muscle guys, you know. I think they all died on the airplanes that were being flown. Interesting, now we just had Donald Rumsfeld leak, slip of the tongue, that Flight 93 was shot down. Well, I proved that 93 was shot down. I think what happened was the passengers broke into the cockpit and found out there was nobody there. Now, what are you going to do then? You got to kill everybody on board, because how are you going to explain that?
Think about that. That's the Flight 93 is the one that was crashed, that crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. You know, Todd Beamer and all those guys say, hey, let's roll. We're going to take this plane back. That sounds very feasible, that they busted in the cockpit and found no one there. And then it was shot down, because you can't have a bunch of, you can't have a plane landing safely with a bunch of citizens saying, hey, there was no one in the plane. And remember what happened in Shanksville. Remember what what we learned in the Zeitgeist movie, that there was nothing left of that plane, just a big depression in the ground. They didn't find one scrap of metal, because the government came and took everything from there and covered it up with dirt or whatever, but the markings on the ground were still there. And if you watch the movie Zeitgeist, you'll see a typical plane crash, like in Nigeria or whatever, see the debris field and how it spread out over a long distance, or, you know, 100 or 200 yards or whatever. The plane crash in Shanksville only has a depression, a gouge in the earth. No material, no debris field, nothing. No body parts, no luggage, no metal, no seats, no seat belts or whatever. Think about that. That plane was shot down, and every bit of that plane was policed up. Now, why do you think they would police up that plane, pick it up, make sure that nothing survived? Because you can put that plane back together, you know, in some hangar somewhere and say, hey, this plane was shot down with a missile. Yeah, the missile entered the left side of the plane right here. I mean, the forensics can do that stuff. So, let's get back to the video.
The Phoenix memo was sat on by Dave Frasca. Then Colleen Rowley, Time Magazine's Woman of the Year in 2003. Remember her? She was the one in Minneapolis who was, you know, saying, how come that FBI headquarters they're suppressing our investigation? They won't let us into this computer. We know what's in here. Do we have to wait for Osama bin Laden to crash a plane into the World Trade Center? I mean, and yet she had Zacharias Moussaoui in custody. And Dave Frasca had completely destroyed that investigation. Then we have Carnivore intercepts of email, which is an email intercept program, very sophisticated technology, also tied to Promise software, where they can intercept all your emails. And they do it with some really great word recognition technology and so forth. But they had a warrant. And this FBI agent walks in on this big warrant where they have all this take. That's the intelligence term. It's the raw data is the take. And he saw that in the midst of these tens of thousands of emails, or 5,000 emails, about Al-Qaeda and terrorist suspects and people wanting to blow up the U.S., there was an email from some Mary Johnson in Denver, Colorado. And according to the official story, the FBI agent was so upset this innocent civilian had her privacy violated that he destroyed all 5,000 emails. Now, look, I know a little bit about the FBI. First of all, the FBI never destroys anything. And the FBI was already into Zacharias Moussaoui's computer. They knew what was there, and they knew, you know, because the FBI only needs a warrant to get evidence into court. But the FBI has been doing black bag jobs since J. Edgar Hoover bought his first dress, you know. Kenny just wrinkled his brow over that one. The FBI could give a hoot about somebody's civil liberties. But Dave Frasca was in charge of that, too. Now, what happened to Dave Frasca after 9/11? He got promoted. Okay. Remember that first elephant with the 9/11 across its butt? That's 9/11. It's over. We all took our best shot. I took my best shot. Now, my book is still out there, but when I say I took my best shot, I mean that in terms of maybe having somebody in government come to senses, a trial, an indictment, an impeachment. Of course, I don't believe anything. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Now, there's other elephants coming at us now in the wake of 9/11. But if you read Crossing the Rubicon, you get how these guys work and how they think. I started the first part of the book with detailed emphasis on what? Economics, did I not? How many people have read the book? Because you've got to understand how money works. Unless and until you change the way money works, you will change nothing. And of course, it may be too late for that anyway. If you were to take a dollar bill out of your wallet and hold it in your hand, and a little glass of crude oil in the other hand. Now, what does the dollar bill represent? If you distill it down, it represents the ability to do something, right? To do work. To buy gasoline for your car, to drive your car, to buy a house, to take an airplane ticket, to buy food, to whatever. It represents the oil is the ability to do work. Money has no value without oil. Von Clausewitz, who said, you know, talked about the fog of war, said that war is a continuation of politics by other means. If he was right about that, then politics is a continuation of economics by other means. And economics is a continuation of energy by other means. You keep looking for the root of the root of the root. We come back to oil. All oil production always follows a bell curve. This is one field. And, you know, let's say, you know, back Giant, the movie Giant with Montgomery Clift. Was it Montgomery Clift? And Elizabeth Taylor and whoever. James Dean. Okay. So they drill a well, you know, and the guys are getting showered in the oil and we're rich. Well, that's what happens when you drill this first well. It's all under pressure. Now, reservoirs are not like a glass because it's sedimentary rock and it's source rock. And sometimes it's more porous and less porous. And, you know, there's all kinds of geologic factors that come into play. But the pressure goes down, but you drill more wells and your production goes up. And eventually the level goes down and you pass this peak and you come down. And that applies whether it's an oil field, the oil in one country, or the oil on planet Earth. The model is the same. Oil discoveries peak in 1962. We now use 4.2-something barrels of oil for every new barrel of oil that is found, and the gap is getting bigger every year. In 2003, there was not a single discovery of a megafield. Now, megafield sounds big, doesn't it, right? Mega, big, right? Like Schwarzenegger, megafield. 500 million barrels in a megafield, right? The world uses a billion barrels of oil every 11.5 days. In 2003, we didn't find a single field with 500 million barrels. That's a clue. Oil discoveries are way off. So there was a great prophetic scientist by the name of M. King Hubbard, who predicted way back in the 50s that the peak of U.S. oil production would come in 1950. They damn near burned him at the stake. I know, I've been close to that a couple of times. But you know what? He was right. So he used the same model to predict a world oil peak somewhere between 2000 and 2010, 2012, based upon consumption. Now, these are creaming curves here, which show actual use. This was the predicted model curve, which shows a peak just shortly after here. But you can see that the creaming curves are all skewed this way. This is hydrocarbon production. This is world population. This is hydrocarbon production per capita. And hydrocarbon production per capita actually peaked on planet Earth in 1979. But notice what happens here, which is what all the ecologists like my dear friend Richard Heinberg and all the great writers who have talked about peak oil calls overshoot, where the population and the demand overshoot the ability to produce and sustain the population. This is the model that is applying to world events right now. From the Wilderness, my newsletter has been active on peak oil since right after 9/11. I have an incredible science editor, Dale Allen Pfeiffer, who was a geologist, who has done some of the most amazing prophetic writing. He has been right so far ahead of the curve. I mean, and I'll show you some examples later on. But finally, on October 1 of last year, when I say we did it, I don't mean from the wilderness, because there are a great many people who were there on peak oil before I was. Colin Campbell, Richard Duncan, Walter Youngquist from Eugene, Oregon, Kenneth DeFaze, many other people active in many, many groups around the world. But we did it because, you know, on October 1st, the G7 group of nations issued a joint statement saying, we have no idea how much oil is really left, and we need to find out. Now, that was after Shell had downgraded its reserves three times in 1 year. Now, let me talk briefly about reserves before we move on. Oil companies trade their stock on Wall Street. They raise money that way. If I'm BP, Amoco, and I discover a field with 600 million barrels of oil, and I announce that all in 1 year, I have to pay taxes on 600 million barrels of oil all in 1 year. Do I want to do that? No. So I say I found 100 million barrels this year, 100 million barrels this year, 100 million barrels this year, and that gives the false illusion from an accounting standpoint that more oil is being discovered in old fields. It's pure accounting hodgepodge. It's hocus pocus. Secondly, the more oil that I state, there are many different levels of reserves. There's proven reserves, there's estimated reserves, ultimately recoverable reserves, all of which are accounting terms. And we even found that Dale Pfeiffer was digging through a report from the Energy Information Administration about reserves that it says are in the ground. And there was a little footnote. You got to read the footnote sometimes. It's a pain in the ass, but it really pays off. Because the footnote said the Energy Information Administration adjusts estimated reserves based upon anticipated demand. What? Huh? Anybody see this last June? All right, let me plant a thought in your mind before we go on here. I get asked this question more often than anything, than any other question. And what it reflects to me is not so much ignorance as the fact that you, like me, like every victim out here who has been conditioned by television and radio National Public Radio and, you know, all of this mind control that's out there, we have been conditioned not to think critically. And probably the single most important question I'm asked, the single most frequent question I'm asked is, hey, Mike, now you can fill in the blank anything you want to. What if the aliens come tomorrow with this whole great new technology? We'll be saved. Okay. Or what about hydrogen? Hydrogen is an insult, a chimera of the most evil kind. Okay. What about zero-point energy? Been demonstrated in the laboratory. Now, so let's assume that tomorrow there's a brand new technology. Will that brand new technology work in your 1996 Toyota Tercel? No. There are 700 million internal combustion-powered vehicles on planet Earth. Each one of those vehicles, according to a couple studies we found, takes on the average between 12 and 15% of all the oil it will ever use in its lifetime just to make. Ah, who had it? All right, I love you. Would you like a cigarette? You read this article here. You've got to make 700 million new vehicles. And that article alone tells you there are 7 gallons of oil in every tire. Now, how are you going to get the minerals out of the ground, build the new factories? That's all hydrocarbon energy. You got to transport them. You got to melt them. You got to generate electricity, move them down. You got to make the paints out of oil. You got to wire the vehicles. That's plastic. Do you understand that it's a no-win solution? Professor David Goodstein of the California Institute of Technology wrote a great book, says very clearly it takes 30 years to change an energy infrastructure. 30 years? We haven't even dealt with the infrastructure issues. Some of the mainstream stories that have acknowledged peak oil, ABC News, this just came out from MIT just 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Major oil headlines in the last year, National Geographic, BBC, Interpress News Agency, Moscow Times, Jane's Defense Weekly, Jane's Intelligence Review, one of the most respected publications on the planet, Foreign Policy in Focus, ABC News, the Sunday Times, that's of London, The Economist, I use them a lot, BBC, U.S. News, Asia Times, Foreign Affairs, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Associated Press, Radio Free Europe, that's the CIA, folks, the Korea Times, Knight Ridder Newspaper, CNN, okay, it's coming out, all right? Peak oil is real. It cannot be denied. Although the mainstream media does a wonderful job of, like, mentioning it but saying, don't worry about it. We're handling it. That's what scares the shit out of me. They're handling it. This just came. There's a friend of mine, Adam Porter, who is a British guy, writes now for Al Jazeera. He used to be a big writer in England, and I wrote when he published a magazine there called Zero. And I wrote for him when he was there. Now he writes for Al Jazeera because he can get the truth out of Al Jazeera. The Al Jazeera English website's actually a damn good site. So he wrote this. Now, here's just a little clue as to what they're hiding, and this is what From the Wilderness does, is that, yeah, the mainstream media lies, but they have to tell the truth because there are actually people who make decisions who read them, and they know kind of where to look and how to read it. Look at this down here. This is Britain. He's writing about Britain. High fuel costs spell winter tragedy. British government. In the UK, up to 52,000 pensioners die during a cold winter. They are classified as excess deaths. That's because Great Britain is running out of energy. The North Sea is in complete decline. There's very little natural gas. 50,000 people may freeze to death in Great Britain this winter because there's no energy, not enough. And it's going to happen here. How many people heat their homes with natural gas? Well, it's like you don't want to admit it. It's like... How many people are gay? I'll get more hands raised than I would. How many people he would that? Okay, how many people here think, oh no, I don't heat with natural gas, I heat with electricity, that's different. Hey, where do you think the electricity comes from? They burn that. Okay, some of it's hydro, but for most of the country it's natural gas or coal. Here's an interesting quote, and this, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is how I might present to you absolute proof that peak oil is real. Quote, if the actions rather than the words of the oil business's major players provide the best gauge of how they see the future, then ponder the following. Crude oil prices have doubled since 2001, but oil companies have increased their budgets for exploring new oil fields by only a small fraction. Likewise, U.S. refineries are working close to capacity, yet no new refinery has been constructed since 1976, and oil tankers are fully booked, but outdated ships are being decommissioned faster than new ones are being built. Is that logical? It is logical only if you understand that the oil companies know that there's no more oil to find and they'll never get a return on investment if they keep building new ships and new refineries that are never going to get paid for. Does that make sense? Here's really scary. ACOR. Right here. The American Council on Renewable Energy. Just had a meeting, this is December 14th, in Washington, and basically what the thrust of the story was, if one actionable priority could be distilled from the chorus of support expressed for renewables, that's wind, solar, all the warm, fuzzy, progressive stuff we like, which I like, which is great. Problems with it. We'll get there in a minute. The American Council on Renewable Energy, it's that the time has come to shift the nation's priorities from an era of research and development to one of major deployment. Now, wait a minute. I grew up when my father was doing work for Martin Marietta on the Titan 3C and other kind of super top secret projects. R&D was the big word. Deployment meant you put it in the field now. And what this whole article says is that renewables have not been anywhere close to perfected, refined. The technology doesn't exist. The infrastructure doesn't exist to make them replace oil. But what the story says is if you don't put whatever you got in the field now, we're done anyway. That's very scary. And you know who one of the big guys in this whole operation is? A guy by the name of James Woolsey. I think he's mentioned here on this page. You know who James Woolsey was? Bill Clinton's first director of Central Intelligence. This is riddled with intelligence people. And what they said was basically, stop trying to make your solar better, stop trying to make your windmills better, stop trying to make, just get it out now. Woolsey is really scary because he's really involved in something I read about in Discover magazine called thermal depolymerization. And you read the story, it is a non-scientific story because they don't talk about something called net energy, how much energy you have to put into something versus how much you get out. But Woolsey was really behind us, this thermal depolymerization, which is some kind of a machine where you can throw in animal waste, animals, and come out with oil. And this article actually said in Discover magazine, which is Disney, that if you throw in a 175-pound man, you'll come out with 30 liters of high-quality oil. And James Woolsey is behind this. Soylent Oil. I mean, give me a break.
End of part. All right, comrades, it's the end of part two of part one of Michael Rupert's talk about peak oil. Like I said on the flip side of this tape, you know, when you'll hear that, I don't know. You may hear this first, I don't know. I have no control over that. You need to consider all the facts that you have all the facts that you've obtained in your personal journey for truth, all the statements that have been made, and they need to be taken with a grain of salt. You can't just take everything at face value. We don't live in that world no more. Consider all the false flag operations that have paved the way for the advancement of their policies. He said in his tape, you got to understand how money works. Well, you know, I don't want to really creep into Wall Street's area of expertise, but it's been my thing lately. I've been more interested in Wall Street and money matters. I have no understanding of it the way Lone Wolf Wall Street does. That's why I think it'd be great if he would do follow-up shows on this subject. Maybe I could... He could, my show could maybe, he could listen to it, maybe take notes and then do a show of his own and expound upon the things that I don't. Because he'd be the guy to talk to about that. So, you know, he quoted von Clausewitz, you know, war is an extension of politics by other means. And he said, politics is an extension of economics by other means, and he took it further. Economics is an extension by energy of other means. Extension of energy by other means. So, so we got to understand how money works. Now, I'm telling you right now, I just can't see the world running out of oil
and the global elitists not having money for, or not having oil for their cars and their planes and their jets. I just don't see it. You got filthy pieces of human shit like Maurice Strong. I know I sound like a broken record talking about him, but hey, you know, he needs to be talked about. Everyone needs to know about this prick. He wants to see the deindustrialization of the United States. He believes that that would be beneficial for the Earth. And we have this new religion coming on the scene now called Gaia, Earth worship. And what's paving the way for all this is that global warming stuff. Now, global warming, I believe, is a hoax. I really do. I believe Al Gore is a dishonorable man. I believe he is a liar. I believe that he is in bed with the internationalist. He's a very, very rich man. Okay? And I'm not saying this because I had a personal bone to pick with his wife back in the 80s when she was kind of declaring war against heavy metal. And I mean, she had some things to say about lyrics of Two Live Crew, which is a rap group out of Miami. I don't give a fuck about them. But I remember when Dee Schneider from Twisted Sister appeared before some congressional committee, you know. So I kind of never liked her because of that. But, you know, and I don't want you to think out there, well, I have a bone to pick with him because of his wife. Well, no, I don't. I think he's a liar. And it's been proven that Edward de Rothschild is really one of the main forces behind this global warming thing. Now, history should teach us we cannot trust any Rothschild. We cannot trust any Rockefeller or Warburg or Felix Frankfurter, you know. We cannot trust them. And they have this new religion coming out, Gaia, you know, got to worship the earth. The red, the green is now the new red. And it's mixed with social justice. And you got to understand, why would black militants like Van Jones be interested in green? I'm talking about green as in the environment. And I'm going to tell you right now, I do not believe what happened in the Gulf was an accident. I believe it was sabotage. It's just my theory. I can't prove it. I'll never be able to prove it. The system is getting very good at covering up things. Just the way they policed up the pieces of that plane in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. So no one will ever be able to determine what brought that plane down. We'll never be able to determine what crashed into the Pentagon. All the pieces of metal that comprised those planes or missiles, whatever they were, they're probably in a foundry right now being remelted and being used for pop cans or something. How many times have you guys heard about the oil companies back in the 70s and 80s and even the 60s buying up technologies that would make the combustible engines obsolete? They've had technologies from the 50s that would make the combustible engine obsolete, but the oil companies would swoop in with a big fat check, buy up the rights to that technology, and no one would ever hear from it again. Can't trust none of this shit. I believe that rig was sabotaged. I've heard this. I want someone out there to check this out. But I heard that the Goldman Sachs took out a catastrophe bond on that rig that supposedly had an accident in the Gulf of Mexico. They took out a what they call a cat bond, catastrophe bond,
on that rig 2 weeks prior to the so-called accident. You guys are smart guys out there. I know you guys will be able to do that. But I just can't see the most powerful people in the world being relegated back to the Stone Age because of peak oil. I just don't see it. I think peak oil is a scam that's going to somehow get everyone off the dependency of their own personal cars. I believe, it's just a theory of mine, I believe that what they want is the only people that's going to have any kind of transportation that has a combustible engine to it. In the future, the only people that will have that will be the elite, will be the people, the very, very powerful people on the planet. And so we'll say, no, that's impossible. They want to keep selling cars to the people. They want the population to go up so they can make more and more money. They don't need to make more money now. They don't need a big population anymore. I'm sure all of you know about the Georgia Guidestones in Alberton, Georgia. Some unknown, extremely rich person had the Georgia Guidestones, which is carved out of pure granite. And there are a number of things that's in the Georgia Guidestone that says, keep the population of the planet under 500 million, no more than 500 million. Unite humanity under one common language. Unite humanity under one religion. Well, what would that religion be? Earth worship. I'm not saying that this is going to be materialized in the next 5 years, but they're on their way. They will create a world that the only thing we could do is react to. I've heard also that they want to rewild the western part of the United States. Haven't you noticed that Greyhound services of small towns out west and to the south have been canceled? Routes have been canceled by Greyhound? Ostensibly because of the economy and the budget and this and that. Bullshit. Routes have been canceled from Amtrak. There's so many towns in the western and southern part of the United States now that the only way to get to is by car. And the only way to get out of those towns is by car. It's like they want to funnel everyone into the big cities. And I mean, what would that do? That would make us dependent on the state. You wouldn't have independent people anymore. I can totally see the system somehow. Now, this is my own thought here, and you can probably think I'm crazy. That's all right. Maybe I am. You're going to see, I think, a proliferation of the birth rates of wild animals. Mountain lions, wolves, coyotes. Pretty much to keep us out of those areas. So we hang out in the cities more often. Cities which will have surveillance cameras everywhere. Cities that will have facial software recognition technology everywhere. I understand that the last Super Bowl, there was a camera scanning the crowds looking for criminals with their facial recognition software. So they can use a crisis to get the population down to a manageable level. Peak oil. Oh, big alarm. We're running out of oil. I just don't buy it. I'm not saying that I won't
end up eating crow a year from now, saying, "Oh, I was wrong." I have no problem stating when I'm wrong about things. A lot of you may think, "Wow, I'm just letting my imagination run wild with me." Well, you know what? That's what happens when you find out that everything you've believed in all your life has turned out to be a lie. But we need to recognize that there are very powerful people who want absolute control over humanity. Could peak oil be the realization of their goal? It would control. Sorry about that little interruption there, comrades. It was a census taker that was ringing my door there. Whatever. But anyways, I believe peak oil could be the realization of that goal. I don't believe peak oil is real, but I could be wrong. But right now, I just don't buy it. I guarantee that the global elite will not allow their lives to be affected by an oil crisis, by a peak oil crisis. I just don't see it. But then again, all those technologies that were swooped up by the oil companies back in the 70s, I don't see I don't see why that they wouldn't put those technologies into practice or take advantage of these technologies. I guarantee you that those technologies are not shoved down some memory hole somewhere. For us, yes. For them, no. Talking about these UFOs and all this other stuff. I don't believe in extraterrestrial beings. I'm not at that point yet, you know. Me and Metzger have talked about on this show a number of times about the possibility that the white race came from someplace else. I'm not going to dismiss that fact because I just don't know. I wasn't around back then. I'm becoming very cynical and critical of almost everything. You know, because there's a lot of lies from history. The victors always write the history. The vanquished don't. So you got to look at what's going on. Rewilding of the West. And check out the Georgia Guidestones. Google it. A lot of you probably know about the Georgia Guidestones. So we need to do that. I like the quote here from Gustav Le Bon in his The Psychology of Revolutions, where he says, "The democracy of lettered classes has no other aim than to set up a selection to recruit the ruling classes exclusively from themselves. Unhappily, the democracy of the intellectuals would simply lead to the substitution of the divine right of kings by the divine right of a petty oligarchy that is too often narrow and tyrannical. They will look out for their own interest. They will not let themselves be, you know, they will not let themselves be affected by the things that affect us. They're beyond. They control the whole damn world. Make no mistake about it." I don't know if I've quoted this before. I might as well quote it again. Albert J. Nock from Memoirs of a Superfluous Man said, "As a general principle, I would put it that a man's country is where the things he loves are most respected. Circumstances may have prevented his ever setting foot there, but it remains his country." How often have we heard about transnational corporations going to, you know, countries throughout the third world and taking all their resources
dispossessing them of their land. And you know who gets to blame for that? The white man gets to blame for that, because most of the time that they're white that do that. But what people of color don't understand is these people do not see themselves as white. Okay? Government is nothing but organized crime. Let me quote again from Albert J. Nock, our enemy, the state. It cannot even be said that the state has ever shown any dispossession to suppress crime. Taking the state wherever found, striking into its history at any point, one sees no way to differentiate the activities of its founders, administrators, and beneficiaries from those of a professional criminal class. Lied to, like me and you, we grew up believing in good government bullshit, that America was the country with the white hats going around the world saving the world. Kate Chesterton's What's Wrong with the World, that says there is the first essential in government, coercion. Okay? They can use straight up coercion by kicking down your door and black clad Praetorian law enforcement people putting a gun in your face with ski mask on, and then they can use coercion through the courts. You have no equality before the law. Albert J. Nock said in Our Enemy the State, the principle of absolutism was introduced into our Constitution by the Income Tax Amendment, the same year that they drafted the Federal Reserve. Nock also said in Our Enemy the State, the sole and variable characteristic of the state is the economic exploitation of one class by another. Now, at the risk of sounding like a protege of Van Jones or something like that, I do recognize that the upper class, and when I say upper class, I'm talking about people who own their own jets. People who have massive amounts of influence in the government. This does not pertain to some white family in the suburbs who makes $200,000 a year. You guys can't even participate in this club. You know, the club of the mega rich. But the middle class is slowly being destroyed. Not by accident, but by design. Okay. G.K. Chesterton said in What's Wrong with the World, says, seemingly from the dawn of man, all nations have had governments, and all nations have been ashamed of them. Robert Louis Stevenson said in Apology for Idlers, idleness, so-called, which does not consist in doing nothing, but in nothing, but in doing a great deal not recognized in the dramatic formularies of the ruling class, has as good a right to state its position as industry itself. Now, he could say that as a right to be lazy. Well, you don't work, you don't eat, they say, right? I'm telling you right now, you need to do it outside of the system. If you can find a way to get around paying taxes, do it. Hang the bosses. It is generally a very bad sign when one is trusted very much by one's employers, said Chesterton. So, it's us or them. It's us against them. Right? Are you free when you are a person trapped in wage slavery? Is there freedom in wage slavery? Albert J. Nock in Our Enemy the State says Adam Smith's economics are not the economics of individualism. They are the economics of landowners and mill owners. And that's what our market is based on. So, I can quote all day long from people who are independent thinkers. The search for truth, it can really rack your brain. I believe you can spend an entire lifetime reading and listening and maybe only have a certain percentage of the truth. And the reason why that is because we have absolutely no control over the destinies of our nation, our corporations, or anything else. I mean, we are not involved in the decision-making apparatus of any of these. You can go vote all you want to. It's not going to make a bit of difference. It's all smokescreen. So, we need to operate outside of the law, outside of the norms of society. We need to not be ruled by social convention. We need to have a veneer of obedience. And that's when it comes to, you know, leading a double life. Ghost wolves during the day need to be law-abiding citizens, but at night they need to live under a totally different preamble. The preamble of white revolution is the only solution. Our race will die off, whether there's a race war or not. If we allow the system to control everything and let them further enslave us with their technologies and manifest their goal stated in the Georgia Guidestones, then our race is gone. Maybe the only chance we have is a full-out race war. Maybe the only chance we have is a bloody revolution against the world global leaders. So we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Carpe noctem, seize the night, starve the sheep inside and feed the wolf. And make shield wall and wolf heart part of your mental makeup. Become wolves in human shape. Find your own freedom where you can. This is Ghost Wolf Radio, bidding you 14 words and Rahoa.
Boys and girls, for Saturn's Day, December the 20th, 2014. And Slingblade will be back with you probably next Wednesday. So, in the meantime, you take it easy. I think I'll add another MP3 on here with some news break. We're getting more people contributing news stories. So, we'll add that on. 14.5. Goodbye.